296, Chapter 20, The Economy, Expansionism, and World War I. Chapter Preview, Terms, New South, Diversity, Truck Farming, Service Industry, Isolationism, World War I, Armistice, Pandemic. People: Henry Grady, Charles Hurdy, John Pemberton, Asa Griggs Candler, Ernest Woodruff, Claude Hatcher, Alonzo Herndon, Morris Rich, Woodrow Wilson. Places: Macon, Columbus, Camp Hancock, Camp Wheeler, Souther Field, Camp Gordon, Camp Benning. During this period, 1877 to 1918, industry became the new economic foundation in much of the country. Southerners had two economic choices: to stay with their established economic path or to go in a new direction. After Reconstruction, most had chosen the old ways. In the 1880s and 1890s, calls for a new way grew. This chapter discusses the choices that Georgians and other Southerners made in earning a living in a modernizing world and the effects those choices had on the state. The changing of the U.S. economy of this era also led to a major change in the country's relationship with other nations in the world. After the Civil War, most Americans, including members of Congress, wanted to remain isolated from the rest of the world. Industrialization, however, created a need for more customers in other parts of the world so growing businesses could continue to expand their markets as they continued to produce goods. Georgia's products were involved in this worldwide trade, and what happened in other places affected Georgia's economy. Even though Georgians at this time preferred to remain out of the affairs of other countries, the nation and the state became involved in World War I. The demand for cotton and textiles boosted Georgia's economy. Georgians became soldiers on battlefields in other parts of the world, and soldiers from other parts of the country trained on military bases built in the state. Page 498, Section 1, The Economy. As you read, look for the New South philosophy, growing industrialization, new businesses in Georgia, terms, New South, diversity, truck farming, service industry. Over the years of Reconstruction and after, the number of tenant farmers and sharecroppers continued to rise. While the majority of the tenants in the early years were African American, increasing numbers of whites became part of that system over time. Some Southern leaders began to call for a change in the economy. They wanted a New South that would become more economically progressive and prosperous. They believed that scientific farming and more industry would put the South on a new economic path. One of the leading advocates in the South for this path was Atlanta's Henry Grady. Some areas did embrace ideas for industry, especially industry related to the products Georgia produced. The number of railroad miles increased to move products from farm, forest, or mine to places where they would be transformed for market. Towns and cities grew larger. Some tried to attract visitors and the money they would bring. In spite of these efforts, change was slow to come to Georgia's economy in most areas of the state. Agriculture. When Reconstruction ended, Georgia farmers continued to plant cotton. In fact, the production of cotton actually spread, along with railroad lines, into areas that had not produced much cotton before the war. This was especially true in backcountry counties around Atlanta and just below Georgia's mountain area. By the 1880s, that area was producing about one-fourth of the state's cotton. Debt pushed many farmers to grow cotton because cotton could be used to get credit while other crops could not. By the middle of the 1880s, cotton production throughout the state rose by about 50%. In the 1880s and early 1890s, the price of cotton remained about 8 to 9 cents a pound. When the Depression of 1893 hit, the price for cotton dropped to less than 5 cents a pound in 1894, before it went back up to over 7 cents a pound in 1895. The price stabilized at 5 to 6 cents a pound for the rest of the 1890s. the early 20th century saw an economic upturn, and cotton prices went up to almost 11 cents a pound in 1903. They went up and down by 2 or 3 cents in the years remaining before World War I. The demand for cotton for the war sent prices soaring. Among those raising cotton were Georgia's farmers who were either cash tenants or sharecroppers. They became an increasingly large percentage of the state's growers. Tenants and sharecroppers overwhelmingly grew cotton rather than other crops. The year's income for tenants depended not only on the success of the cotton crop, but also on the ups and downs of the world cotton market. Bad weather or low prices could mean a year of little to no income, which meant going into debt to plant next year's crop. One legacy, long-term effect, of this system on the state and the rest of the Lower South was long-term poverty. Sharecroppers found it almost impossible to get out of debt. When middle-class farmers got into debt, they often had to sell pieces of their land to pay off the debt. When their land was all sold, they too became sharecroppers. One-third of Georgia's farmers were tenants by 1880, and that number grew with every census. Another legacy of this system was the continued dominance of cotton, the exact opposite of what Henry Grady and other New South spokesmen had hoped. Most tenants planted cotton up to the very houses they lived in. Landowners demanded that land not be wasted planting crops that could not be sold, so few tenants even had gardens. That meant that in an agricultural society, most sharecroppers were malnourished because they did not produce food to feed themselves. In the end, only Mother Nature could force Southerners to stop growing so much cotton. That did not happen until the 1920s, when an insect called the boll weevil ate its way from the cotton fields of Texas to Georgia. As cotton production increased, fewer acres were planted in other crops, especially corn. This was not what those who called for a New South wanted. They believed that farmers should diversify or grow more crops of different kinds. There were some land-owning farmers who did experiment with new crops. For sharecroppers, however, it was too risky. New South believers urged farmers to farm scientifically by using fertilizer and methods such as crop rotation, planting a different crop in a particular field from one year to the next. On a small scale, some farmers tried growing vegetables and fruits for market, a practice that came to be called truck farming. At first, the crops were sold in local or regional markets, but railroads made it possible to ship goods faster before they began to rot. In the 20th century, refrigerated railroad cars made shipping crops to even faraway markets more possible. During the 1880s, Georgia began to produce a product for which it would become well known in the mid-20th century, peaches. Two new varieties of peaches were actually developed in Georgia, Alberta's and Bell's. Pecans also provided income for some Georgians. Georgia farmers also raised livestock, including cows, hogs, and sheep. It would take a long time to replace the animals that had been lost during the war. In spite of these exceptions, the major cash crop of Georgia remained cotton. Page 501, Industrialization. When the Civil War was over, Georgia had much to rebuild. Some wartime industries began to close as the state reoriented for a peacetime economy. But other industries began to rebuild. The New South supporters, many of whom lived in the state's growing cities, strongly believed in bringing more manufacturing to the South. That would shift some of the South's economy toward industry and have it be less dependent on agriculture. The most well-known of the New South spokesmen was Georgia's Henry Grady, managing editor and partial owner of the Atlanta Constitution newspaper. He first used the term New South in a piece he wrote for another newspaper before coming to work for the Constitution. He made a major speech in New York in 1886, trying to convince Northerners to invest money in Southern industry, especially in Atlanta. Grady was a great promoter of that city, and some of its growth is attributable to his efforts. The industries in Georgia that did emerge and grow in the period before World War I related to the raw materials Georgia produced. By the 1880s, the industries that Georgia had before the Civil War were up and going again. That included sawmills that made board from Georgia trees, especially pine, and grist mills that ground corn or other grains into flour. As they had in the colonial period over 100 years earlier, Georgians once again began to produce naval stores from pine trees. In 1902, University of Georgia chemist Charles Hertie developed a new technique for collecting the sap from the pine trees that helped revive that industry. Textiles. The major revitalized industry was the textile industry, which produced cloth from Georgia's cotton. This was an industry in which Northerners were willing to invest their money. Southerners with money joined with Northern investors to build mills throughout the state. The fall-line cities especially benefited. Augusta, mainly with Chinese-American labor, enlarged and deepened its canal in the mid-1870s. By the early 1880s, three major new mills had been built on its banks. The mills used the water from the canal to turn the shafts, gears, and pulleys that spun and wove cloth from raw cotton fiber. In 1876, the Bibb Manufacturing Company began in Macon and soon had several mills and mill villages. Columbus got its mills up and operating quickly after the war. The Eagle and Phoenix Company, owned by William H. Young, built several mills during Reconstruction. In 1887, George Parker, Jr. of Columbus built his first textile mill, adding two more in 1904 and 1916. Columbus weaver Prince Green became president of the National Union of Textile Workers in 1898 and moved its headquarters to Columbus. Columbus became a major center for the textile industry. The west central area of Georgia also saw textiles as a good economic investment. To promote this industry, Georgia held major national expositions or fairs to advertise its progress. Atlanta held fairs in 1881 and 1887. In 1895, Atlanta was host to 800,000 visitors during the three-month-long Cotton States and International Exposition. This exhibition was a way to showcase the economic recovery of the South, in which cotton played a large role, to highlight the region's natural resources, and to lure Northern investors. At the 6,000 exhibits of the exhibition, visitors saw new machinery and learned how cotton was made into marketable products. The textile mills put hundreds of Georgians, men, women, and children, to work. Many saw the mills as a good opportunity for Civil War widows who could not manage farms alone. As it became difficult for some farmers to make a living on small plots of land, they too came to the cities to get jobs in the mills. Most mills built housing, which they then rented to the farmers. Mill villages or neighborhoods developed their own community life. Churches were built, often mission churches from denominations in the cities. Sometimes elementary schools were built, although many children worked in the mills. Children had little time for school because work was 6 days a week and 11 to 12 hours a day in most mills. New businesses. In addition to these older industries, a few new business enterprises were founded in this period. In 1886, Atlanta pharmacist John Pemberton was working in one of the drugstores of Jewish businessman Joe Jacobs. Pemberton invented a health drink made from the cocoa leaf and kola nut, which he sold mixed with bubbly water. His partner, Frank M. Robinson, called it Coca-Cola. A few years later, Asa Griggs Candler, another druggist and businessman, bought the formula for the syrup. He sold it to pharmacies for their soda fountains where they could mix it with seltzer water. Some business leaders in various communities bought rights to bottle the drink and sell it that way. Families in several Georgia towns became wealthy bottling and selling the popular beverage. In 1914, the Coca-Cola Bottlers Association was founded by the Coca-Cola Company. In 1919, a group of businessmen in Atlanta, led by Ernest Woodruff, bought the company and eventually took the brand worldwide. That major expansion is a story for another chapter. Coca-Cola was not the only Georgia soft drink to emerge. In the early 1900s, Columbus pharmacist Claude Hatcher developed a bottled drink to sell in his family's grocery store. It too became popular and developed into a business eventually called Royal Crown Cola. In the 1920s, the company expanded into fruit-flavored drinks called Knee-High. Tourism. Another industry that was born during the late 1800s and early 1900s was not a manufacturing industry, but what we now call a service industry because it provides a service to people. That was the tourism industry. Some enterprising Georgians realized that the state's mild climate might attract wealthy northerners who wanted to vacation away from the cold and snow of their winters. One of the most successful of these ventures was in the Golden Isles of Georgia's coast. In 1886, the same year that John Pemberton began selling Coca-Cola, Jekyll Island was purchased as a retreat for a group of northern businessmen, including banker J.P. Morgan, department store owners Marshall Field and Everett Macy, railroad owner William Vanderbilt, and newspaper giant Joseph Pulitzer. In addition to a shared clubhouse, members of this Jekyll Island Club built cottages and apartments for themselves on the island. Hunting, bicycling, and other recreation provided relaxing winter getaways for these men and their families during the winter months. The Jekyll Island Club was exclusive, allowing only a few members, but other wealthy northerners came to other Georgia cities for winter vacations. In Augusta, the chance to play golf on the Bon Air Links and enjoy luxury accommodations attracted the owners of Quaker Oats Company, Majestic Stove Company, and politicians such as President William Howard Taft. These tourists created jobs in local hotels, restaurants, and businesses that catered to visitors. They also brought much-needed outside money into the local economies. Even though these economic enterprises are Georgia success stories, the vast majority of Georgians in this era remain tied to the land. For many, it was not even land they owned. Georgia was not nearly as new as Henry Grady and others had hoped the state would become. Nor was life different for many. The farther away from a city one lived, the more likely one's life was much the same as it had always been. Urbanization and business. After the Civil War, some Georgians, both blacks and whites, continued to move into Georgia's towns and cities, which all saw growth. Railroads continued to expand after Reconstruction and were a major factor in town growth. Almost 2,000 new miles of rail lines were built in the 1880s alone. Towns sprang up along those lines. Points along the rails with depots became hubs for the surrounding countryside. Farmers came to bring their crops to ship and often to buy the supplies they needed. Stores began to locate near the train depots. So did those who provided services, from blacksmiths to lawyers. A farmer could buy his supplies, get a haircut and shave, have his horses shoed, and make out a will during a visit to town. Places where more than one railroad met grew even more. No city boomed more quickly than Atlanta. With several railroads, it had been a transportation and supply center during the Civil War. After the destruction of the war, its railroads were rebuilt, keeping it the transportation center of the state. In 1868, it also became the capital of the state, and government offices relocated there. With its access to transportation in all directions, Atlanta attracted businesses such as banks and insurance companies. One example is the insurance company now known as Life of Georgia. Chartered in Georgia in 1897, the company sold health and life insurance policies to working-class Georgians. Customers paid on their policies weekly, which made it more affordable. This type of company offered job opportunities that could earn a middle-class lifestyle. African-American entrepreneurs also established insurance companies. Many began as mutual aid societies. These were voluntary organizations of members who paid into a general pool and paid out to a member for a specific purpose, such as an emergency or death. Such societies then incorporated into companies. The first African-American-owned company was Pilgrim Health and Life Insurance Company, founded in 1898 in Augusta by Walter Hornsby and Solomon Walker. Like Life of Georgia, its target customers were working-class people. Agents collected small policy payments on a weekly basis. The company not only wanted to make money, but to provide a service to their people. Born the son of his slave owner and a slave mother, Alonzo Herndon worked with his African-American family members as a sharecropper for many years after the Civil War. He was an enterprising young man who managed to save enough money to move from the fields to the city. He learned the trade of barbering and eventually moved to Atlanta. After working for another barber for a while, he established his own barber shop. Herndon and the men he hired had excellent reputations for service to their all-white clientele, including some prominent Georgians. The money he made allowed him to invest in real estate. He owned many properties and eventually became the wealthiest African-American in Atlanta. In 1905, Herndon bought what later became Atlanta Life Insurance Company. Herndon was a founding member of the National Negro Business League, which Booker T. Washington began, and one of the founders in 1905 of the Niagara Movement, spearheaded by W.E.B. Du Bois. His first wife was a professor at Atlanta University. Herndon and his wife became important figures in the life of African Americans in Atlanta, providing leadership and funding for many social service nonprofit organizations and for Atlanta University. Atlanta's growing population also led to more retail stores. One example was Rich's, founded by Morris Rich, a Jewish merchant who came to Atlanta from Cleveland, Ohio. He began operating a dry goods store, which eventually turned into a major department store. Rich's popularity was based on the fine customer service for which the store became known. In 1914, for example, in response to the poor cotton prices that affected many of the store's customers, Rich's allowed customers to use cotton to pay for goods, even though the store would lose money. For decades, Rich's was a major attraction in downtown Atlanta, and people from other parts of the state traveled there to shop. In the mid-1990s, Rich's became part of Macy's. Other cities grew as well, especially those on the Fall Line, where goods were brought to be shipped downriver to the ports. By the late 1800s and early 1900s, cities had access to many of the new inventions of the age. For example, electricity came to Georgia's cities. Electricity not only provided lighting, but ran machines in both factories and homes. It was also used to power streetcars, which became important means of transportation that allowed cities to grow outward. City people's lives became much more convenient with indoor plumbing, electricity, and delivery of ice, which was put in ice boxes to preserve food. Not everyone who lived in cities, however, could afford all these new ways of living. Away from the cities, the home lives of Georgia's farmers and rural people had few of these new conveniences. Reviewing the section, 1. Define diversity, truck farming, service industry. 2. What Georgia city was a center for the textile industry at this time? 3. What business did Alonzo Herndon found? Page 508, Georgia Portraits. Henry W. Grady, Voice of the New South. No Southerner was better known as a spokesman for the New South philosophy than Georgia's Henry Woodfin Grady. As a journalist and newspaper editor, he encouraged both industrialization and diversifying agriculture. Born in 1850 to a prominent Athens family, Grady lost his father during the Civil War. The young Grady went on to graduate from the University of Georgia. He also studied at the University of Virginia before returning to Georgia to work in journalism at the Rome Courier. While in Rome, he married his childhood sweetheart, Julia King. After the Courier went out of business, the Gradys moved to Atlanta, where he became a partner in the Atlanta Daily Herald. In his writings, he encouraged more industries, especially those that involved turning the South's crops and resources into finished products. His talent as a writer led to an offer to buy part ownership of the Atlanta Constitution and to become its managing editor. During those years, from 1880 to 1889, Grady became known for his insightful, timely, and sometimes controversial editorials, as well as his rousing speeches. One of his most famous speeches was delivered to the New England Society in December 1886. Entitled "The New South," the speech proclaimed that the prejudices of war had died in the South. He saw in the future a united North and South. In this and other speeches, he tried to persuade Northerners to invest money in the Southern economy. Grady's ability to sell the concept of a New South helped bring jobs, recognition, and investments to the recovering Georgia economy. He backed up his words with actions. Grady was a strong supporter of making Atlanta a model New South city. He was one of the principal planners for Atlanta's 1881 International Cotton Exposition. He worked to establish the Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech, and he helped raise funds to develop the Young Men's Christian Association building in Atlanta. In 1889, Grady traveled to Boston in his continuing efforts to promote Southern industry. One of his more famous quotes was in that speech. "I attended a funeral once in Pickens County in my state. They buried him in the midst of a marble quarry. They cut through solid marble to make his grave, and yet a little tombstone they put above him was from Vermont. They buried him in the heart of a pine forest, and yet the pine coffin was imported from Cincinnati. They buried him within touch of an iron mine, and yet the nails in his coffin and the iron in the shovel that dug his grave were imported from Pittsburgh. They buried him by the side of the best sheep-grazing country on the earth, and yet the wool in the coffin bands and the coffin bands themselves were brought from the north. The South didn't furnish a thing on earth for that funeral but the corpse and the hole in the ground. There they put him away, and the clods rattled down on his coffin, and they buried him in a New York coat and a Boston pair of shoes, and a pair of breeches from Chicago, and a shirt from Cincinnati." Grady became ill during his time in Boston. By the time he returned to Atlanta, he had developed pneumonia. He died on December 23, 1889, at the age of 39. Grady County and Grady Memorial Hospital both carry his name. So does the Henry W. Grady School of Journalism at the University of Georgia, one of the most highly respected journalism programs in the country.